Blog Talk Radio.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. We just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, girl. Just you and me. Wake up, all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long. For their judgment day, so won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. Let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, just you and me.
That's right. Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in the bed. No more thinking backwards. Because MPH says, this is the second day of December, 2023. We'd like to welcome you to another special show for Missing Pages of History Radio. Like always, we're going to try to do our best, give you our best, because you are the best. Let's continue to fill in our missing pages of history. At the Voice of MPH Radio, what we're going to do today is we're going to follow the agenda of first giving you something to think about. Then we have a special, A Voice from France, with our sister Wincy Grammer, followed by The Voice from France. We're going to have a special Missing Pages of History, Black Benefacts, the first Black King, James. And after that particular segment, we will have a critical discussion. Yes, we're going to have a critical discussion from a documentary, which you can find on YouTube, which is titled No Africa Will Pass This Without Reacting to This. It should be No Africans Will Pass This Without Reacting to This. We can discuss some critical issues and points from that particularly well put together documentary. And then we have a special message to the community from Alex. And of course, our announcements and how you can support MPH Radio. So that's the order for today. If you run into any technical problems, bear with us. We're trying to straighten these things out. A lot of these issues are those issues that are above our control. So, as we said, we're going to do our best, give you our best, because you're the best. This is the Voice of MPH Radio. So we're going to begin our program right now to give you something to think about. And that thing is freedom. What is freedom? Freedom is something talk about, fought about, died over, but people still fighting over this concept of freedom. Let me just give you a conceptual idea of what freedom is, and you tell me how it fits into your world. Freedom is having the ability and means to control those necessities for life. Again, the definition of freedom is having the ability and means to control those necessities for life. Think about that. Let us know what you think about it and share with us your concept of freedom as we begin to go through the program and discuss critical issues. Now, what we want to do, we are a global institution, MPH Radio, and we have global perspectives. So right now we're going to A Voice from France. We're going to A Voice from France with Sister Wincy. We're going to bring her in. She's a writer, an artist. She has many skills. So Sister France will share some perspective out of France. So Wincy, you are the voice from France. The mic is yours. Welcome to MPH Radio. Yes, Sister Wentz, you can speak now. Welcome to MPH Radio. My sister, can you hear us? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, the mic is yours. Welcome to MPH Radio. You can speak.
Yes. Yes, I will speak.
Yes.
I am Ruth Engendray, journalist, author, singer. In a few days, I will propose a policy to my city in France for a shop and a restaurant for the pupils in middle school and high school, without Red Bull, without alcohol, with the food, with the list of calories in the plate, and I want to fight against anorexia among the young people and overweight among the young people. At least we can have a good meal when we are teens. If I have a victory for this policy to harass Arras is my city, and I sent an article on the idea to Michelle Obama and Barack Obama, because the Obamas created Let's Move for the children. After,
okay, my sister.
After, I want to present for 2024 my video game for my creation of video game. It will be available on Amazon in September, and I name this game Landscape Simulator. And I wait to receive a customer, and in May 2024, I go to New York for my birthday. And I will create a manifesto for the Socialist Party in France, and I will support Ségolène Royal even if she is not candidate.
Okay.
And I met Hillary Clinton this year. I was on TV in New York. I wrote a book this year. I made my concert for the summer 2023, and I met Amélie Nothomb, a great writer in Europe and a leader for Death with Dignity.
All right, my sister, we'd like to thank you for sharing what's going on in your life, your work of creating a video game coming out. You're going to be doing some political writing, dealing with the socialist parties in France, and your visit to New York, if I heard you correctly, you may be coming back sometime in the future. So what we're going to do is we're going to stay in touch with you. We want you to just keep us aware of what's going on in your life and what you're doing, but what's the movement like in France. So we'd like to thank you for making your contribution to today's program on what's going on from a voice from France. Thank you, my sister. We thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was Sister Wentz, a voice from France. Now what we're going to do is, we're going to make our transition, get out your pens and your paper, and we're going to play this documentary, which we'd like to thank all of the researchers and writers who wrote this particular historical piece as it relates to our history. And the title of this piece is King James, the Black King. Now, since this is a season where many people are going to be talking about the history and the practice of Christianity and the three wise kings and king this and king that, we're going to play this piece for you, and hopefully you learn something. Welcome to our MPH Black Men Facts. Today's documentary is King James, the Black King. This is MPH Radio.
I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich. Welcome to the Black Excellence and Abundance Channel. King James, the first of England, who authorized the translation of the now famous King James Bible, was considered by many to be one of the greatest, if not the greatest, monarchs that England had ever seen. Through his wisdom and determination, He united the warring tribes of Scotland into a unified nation, and then joining England and Scotland to form the foundation for what is now known as the British Empire. At a time when only the churches of England possessed the Bible in English, King James' desire was that the common people should have the Bible in their native tongue. Thus, in 1603, King James called 54 of history's most learned men together to accomplish this great task. At a time when the leaders of the world wished to keep their subjects in spiritual ignorance, King James offered his subjects the greatest gift that he could give them, their own copy of the Word of the Most High in English. James, who was fluent in Latin, Greek, and French, and schooled in Italian and Spanish, even wrote a tract entitled Counterblast to Tobacco, which was written to help prevent the use of tobacco in England.
King James was a king of Great Britain, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. King James was a black man, and the King James Bible is named after King James I of England, who lived from June 19, 1566 to March 27, 1625.
The established church was divided during this era. In 1603, King James called a conference in the Hampton Court in an attempt to resolve issues. As a result, a new translation and compilation of approved books of the Bible was commissioned to resolve issues with translations then being used. For example, the Geneva version contained controversial marginal notes that proclaimed the Pope was as an antichrist. The leaders of the church desired a Bible for the people, with scriptural references only for word clarification or cross-references. King James approved 54 scholars to work on the translation, and 47 worked in six groups at three locations for 7 years, comparing to previous English translations such as the Geneva Bible and texts in the original languages. The new translation was published in 1611 and called the Authorized Version because it was authorized to be read in the churches. It later became known as the King James Version. King James was the first to succeed in perfecting the English translation of the Bible. He successfully distributed around the world. King James gathered Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek scholars who were also well-versed in the English language. Many among these scholars were black. Medieval Hebrew had been widely used by the Moors, along with Arabic, because a large portion of the Moors were Israelites. The blacks of Scotland had Ethiopian Hebrew ancestry, and they shared the same history of the Hebrew monarchs of Ethiopia. King James himself could trace his ancestry to the tribe of Judah. The name James, meant to supplant, was interchangeable with the name Jacob. In Europe, the letter J was not used until the time of King James, whose team of scholars, who included some of Hebrew extraction, was responsible for its introduction in the English alphabet. Names like Judah and Jesus were pronounced as Yehuda and Jesus, respectively, until the time of King James. This is something that many of our subscribers and viewers of this channel have pointed out in previous videos in the comment section.
The King James translation had a significant influence on the English language and was widely accepted as the standard English Bible. Because of the project being overseen by King James and the care and precise attention to detail during this 7-year translation, the King James Bible was considered one of the most accurate translations in existence. This black king was the first to sit on three thrones at once, which was Scotland, England, and Northern Ireland. The King James 1611 Bible also included the Apocrypha. For various reasons, 14 books were subsequently taken out of the 1611 King James Bible. Thankfully, the 1611 King James Version is still available, which includes the Apocrypha. We would also like to point out that the Moors settled in Spain and southern Europe in 711 CE. Significant numbers of black people found their way to northern Europe countries such as Scotland, Ireland, France, and Denmark. Since the beginning of the first millennium, the nations of Scotland and Ireland had a significant number of blacks who in Scotland wielded political power as the kings and rulers. This is a little-known fact in black history. In 1565, Queen Mary was married by her cousin, a black Scottish man of the royal family, who was called Darnley. Darnley was killed in 1567, but he had left the queen a male heir of her own lineage. Queen Mary's son James was born a few months before his father's murder. Thus, he became the first king of England. James VI was therefore the son of a black man and a colored woman. We often hear about black royalty in Africa, but it is a little known fact that there was actually royalty in Europe as well. Yes, folks, King James, the translator of the Bible, was a black man. Let me say, one of the translators of the Bible. As you know, the Bible has been translated many, many times, but the most popular version in use in America for many years has been the King James Version. His actual version was the King James 1611, which included the Apocrypha. The Black Excellence and Abundance Channel, where black history is every day.
Please remember to like, comment, share, and subscribe. And remember, thou art rich.
dedicated to people like me, those that struggle with insecurities, acceptance, and even self-esteem. You never felt good enough, you never felt pretty enough, but imagine God whispering in your ear, letting you know that everything that has happened is now. All gone. Every sin, every mistake, every failure, it's all gone. Depression, gone. By faith, gone. Low self-esteem, hallelujah, it's gone. It's all gone. It's gone. All my scars, all my pain, it's in the past. Yesterday, it's all gone.
It's all gone.
What your mother did,
gone.
What your father did,
gone.
Hallelujah.
We'd like to welcome you back to MPH Radio as you listen to our Black MPH Black Benefact on the history of King James. And, you know, this is a season where people are going to be celebrating and honoring certain aspects of the Christian religion, Christianity. And it becomes important if you're going to practice something. We believe that you should know not only the history of it, but particularly your history related to it. So we hope you enjoy that little Black Minifact on King James, the Black King. And right now we're going to make our transition to an interesting topic, which today is we are guests in our own home and community. There was a documentary that is produced on YouTube, and we give our thanks and respect to the originators and the creators of this document, and we encourage you to go and listen to it. There's so much information that you can learn from and issues that need to be raised as relates to how do we as a people, as African people, move forward and create a brighter, powerful, and united Africa. Back home. The name of this particular work is No Africans Will Pass This Without Reacting to This. So what we're going to do is we're going to have just a little open dialogue with you and our members and listeners on this particular little documentary. It's in lessons that you may have taken from this and how we can use this to raise our consciousness so we can make a better world for our people and all humanity. So let's just have a little discussion, dialogue, and if you would like to participate, you can call in as well to 818-337-0016, press 1, and we will acknowledge your last four numbers. So to start us all, we have my co-host, Brother Alex. You had a chance to view the documentary. We just gonna ask you and our listening audience first, just give us a general, some general feedback on some of the takes, some of the thoughts, some of the issues that were raised that you felt were critical as relates to concretizing the consciousness of our community, the underserved community, the African community. Brother Alex, we'll turn the mic now over to you for some of your thoughts.
Well, good day, Mr. Lee and Sister Susie and all the guests and the speakers that may come on today. And I thank you in the beginning And the reason why I thank you for even listening today is because, again, Mr. Lee, you bring us some knowledge here that we need to absorb today. I've always thought of the times in school when kids didn't even want to even study about Africa because they didn't even know what it was about. To me, it was one of the largest land masses on the globe. And I knew that having such a huge land mass, then it must be a lot of different people and cultures and languages. It had to be much more because it was larger than what we call the USA. So when I look at this documentary, that just reinforced me in all the problems that are happening in Africa today that happened years ago and that are happening in America today, that the similarities are so close together. One of the biggest similarities, though, I took from the document is we have to love each other first. Because we as a people were taught this by our ancestors to have self-respect and dignity and character, and that we told truth and that we took responsibility and we held each other accountable, but we didn't tear down one another. We didn't look for a fight with one another, but we looked to build upon the relationship of fellowship and friendship and kinship and relationships toward business and trade and whatever that we could have. That first instance of loving yourself first is everything. And as we reach out, we begin to love our families and our kinfolks, the people that come into your life on a daily basis, that you have respect for them. Even if you don't agree with everything, you have respect for the common individual. But there were so many things that it talked about. Oh, my God, about the Africa having one currency, having a united military, having an African court of justice. I mean, to bring tribes together and to unite them on one front, to have one language. There were just so many things. And then reparations. Oh, my God. Africans talking about reparations from their European colonizers. So, and then we talked about Africa's future and how she could be united in the trade of her minerals and wealth. And so it's just so much there. I don't want to cover everything, but we got to understand that this was a very colonized continent that brought many people over from many nations to here. Just like we as African Americans in this country don't seem to get along and bond like we should. There were reasons why the Europeans separated us and kept us separated, and they continue the same attitude with Africa. So I give you back the mic, and I hope I didn't cover everything for everybody, but, you know, it just was so much to learn, so much to learn. But Lee, I have to thank you tenfold right now for giving me this information. You're just wonderful, brother, and I appreciate you.
Okay, let's go to our caller, 6029. Just a general observation, caller, for some of the things you may have taken from this documentary, which, by the way, the presenter or speaker was the president of the EFF, Economic Freedom Fighter, for Zaire, South Africa, Brother Julius Lumumba. But, caller, we just starting off with the generalities. What were some of the things that you took from this presentation and that would be of value to conscientize our people on? Call the 6029. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I thought that a lot of the points that were presented in the documentary were appropriate. I think they're very, very instructive, and there's no question about that. But the bigger picture is in terms of, you know, just how do we get there. One of the things, you know, that the document didn't deal in depth with was the question around the process involved in terms of getting there. We all acknowledge that the injustices, systematic and otherwise, that impact African people is very, very real. The question is whether or not, what are we going to do in terms of resolving those conditions that we're confronted with? See, one of the problems is that if we don't fully understand the nature of those systems that impact our lives, then the reality is our ability in terms of resolving the problems that we're confronted with based upon the system becomes very, very impossible to implement. So it becomes extremely important in terms of understanding precisely what those systems entail and how they carry out the oppression of the mind in terms of being able to condition us to behave a certain way. I think one of the things is that there is a great great resistance in terms of dealing with a lot of those issues in terms of that adversely impact us as African people. One of the things we have to understand, and when we talk about the historical role in terms of, you know, political conditioning or social conditioning of our people, that we have to understand that, you know, that the impact has been devastating. For many of us, the reality in terms of confronting who we are becomes very, very difficult. In fact, one of the things in terms of that prevents, you know, any kind of unity is the fact that a lot of us really don't want to deal with the question in terms of who we are and what we are. To the extent that we have been programmed to accept the narrative painted by, you know, Western forces or Western leadership or the Western states, determines that to the extent that we're able to actually rise above the situation we currently confront with. And one of the things that when we talk about this question in terms of love, one of the things we have to fundamentally understand is that love may not be sufficient in terms of bringing about the kind of redress that we seek in terms of trying to bring about a new paradigm. Because one of the things we have to understand that, you know, I may love you or respect you or whatever, but the bottom line, if what you do is counterproductive or destructive to the aspirations of African people, then the question in terms of love really becomes mute because love is not going to give us where we need to be. We need some concrete, definitive understanding in terms of situations that our people are confronted with in society. And so the struggle has to be in terms of having that discussion, that kind of discourse, around the objective reality that our people find themselves confronted with. To the extent that this kind of objective reality is going to rub a lot of people the wrong way in the African community, we have to fundamentally understand that that's a fact of life. And for those people, they're not going to perceive what you're saying as loving. They're going to perceive it as antagonistic because, in other words, you're challenging their worldview. And they don't want you to challenge their worldview. They want to believe, in fact, that everything is fine. Everything is, the only real problems that exist is in the mind of African people, and that the role the system plays in terms of fomenting all this kind of injustice against African people is merely a figment of our imagination, that the system is fine, the problem is the people or African people. So clearly this question in terms of love is theoretically sounds good, but in all practicality, one of the things that in terms of trying to bring about resolution to the problems that we're confronted with, it calls for clarity, understanding, and that doesn't encompass love because the bottom line is that, you know, love can only take place to the extent that people are in agreement in terms of understanding the situation they're confronted with. Once you understand the situation you're confronted with, then, of course, it creates the foundation to bring into evidence this question in terms of love. But barring any kind of clarity in terms of what's going on in society, it's very difficult for one person on one hand to struggle for justice and equality, while at the same token another person struggling against justice and equality to come together under the guise of love. So clearly, this question in terms of love all sounds good. But the bottom line is we don't need love. What we need is clarity, political and social clarity. And without that clarity, any kind of unity in terms of bringing forth a different paradigm simply becomes impossible. And I close with that.
All right, caller, we put you on hold. Thank you. Let's go to our next caller, Susan. Your take from the documentary.
Okay, like everyone said, this documentary had a whole lot of things in it, and the whole thing, one thing I got out of it is that with Africa, not only do we have to consider the Africans there, we also have to consider us here abroad just as well. And one thing, it's the time for Africans to come and unite and fight colonialism and neocolonialism. If we can deal with those two issues, which are big issues, then we can acquire the full or partial political control over what we must do for our countries abroad as well as here in the Americas. And also just the fact that he brought up a lot of the, it included a lot of the people in the past who have done things to try to make things better for Africans all over, Marcus Garvey, Nelson Mandela, and stuff, to know that he's putting himself in the light of trying to continue what these people started for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Caller 4298, your generous analysis of the documentary. 4298, the mic is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, brother. This is Robert Moses. This was Julius Malemba, I believe, that we're talking about, and he's a righteous brother, certainly a Pan-Africanist, and he had a program, a Pan-Africanist program, and Brother Alex, said some of it. I think most Pan-Africans know what he's talking about, and I don't want to elaborate on that. I wouldn't use the time to the best of my advantage. And so let me say that the kingdom of heaven is preached. That's Luke 16:16. And, repetition is the mother of invention. We're talking about how to solve the problem. Repetition is the mother of inventions. Moses went to the mountain. Jesus was the mountain. The mountain came to Muhammad. Muhammad said, "What's love got to do with it? These Christians are oppressing my people." So he wrote the Quran. Only a fool would say there is no God. Mao Tse Tung was the foolish old man who moved the mountain. The people of China stormed heaven in 1949. And the solution, revolution is the solution. Thank you.
Okay, call 7236. Your response to the documentary, 7236.
Very informative, and I really have no comment. I was just listening in, and the familiarity with the translation of the Bible and the dropping of the 14 books is very interesting. My question would be, where are the 14 books today? Are they held in the Vatican, or are they in the military settler state in Palestine that is called Israel? Where are they actually stored, these documents?
Caller, that's a good question. Anyone has the answer? We also would like to know, where are the so-called the 14 missing books? That's in the King James Version perspective. But anyway, let's continue the discussion from this documentary. We just want to highlight some interesting observations that were raised in this presentation, which I thought was sort of interesting, where he really was talking about the weaknesses and maybe the powerlessness of African leadership. When he talked about 51 heads of states was somewhat committed to or solicited to go to a meeting, you only meet one head of state. It wasn't a relationship of power to power, state to state. He talked about something's wrong with the picture, where you have 54 heads of states coming to the demand and request or the call to one head of state. Something is wrong with that picture. Brother Alex, how do you interpret that particular aspect?
Well, Brother Lee, we have to realize that when it comes to people governing countries, whether they're dictators, monarchs, kings, or whatever type leadership or rulership you have, it is hard for a leader to come forward and say, give all the solutions in any summit meeting. And when these gentlemen got together this, you know, particular time, again, so many of them were still favoring their imperialists and colonial masters. So when you still got France and Germany and England over your shoulder, then there's only so much of a line that you might want to walk because you feel reprisals, you know, from them. And so when you have so many countries in Africa that are not independent thinkers of their own economy, of their own military, of their own trading, and where you can't even move from country to country, you know, because it's limited and it's avoided. And they're just so decisive because it's been planted there for years of colonialism. So when you have all that decisiveness, you know, to begin with, it is hard for any leaders to get together and decide what is best common country on that continent. So each country is going to come in with their own ideas, their own sets of wants or whatever, and it may not be in the best interest of the people as we deal with dictators and people who have their own interests at heart and not the people's interests at heart. That was the most sterilizing thing that you know, I found out, you know, of about any meeting, it seems like, that when it comes together in Africa, it seems like so many people have their own agenda. And before they put the people with what they need and what the country needs and how they need to get ahead. And so when you're dealing with the society that's all around them, which is mostly the capitalist society that's pushing the world, moving the world economies around, then that is detrimental, you know, to nations that are being developed, you know, as we call them third world, second world, third world countries, because they do not have the resources of the United States or Russia or China. So when you're not on that level and you're much further down, it is much harder, you know, to come together as a collective, you know, in an environment where you can make concrete decisions, you know, for your people. So I'm going to turn the back mic over because, you know, I want to hear some other opinions here, as I always do, because, you know, that's what enriches me, you know, is having that dialogue, you know, so that I can also learn, not just to talk about stuff, just that I can also learn, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Alex. Caller 6029, continue the same line of thought, same question. I'd like to get your feedback on the look of what does it say we have 54-51 heads of state comes out of their country to meet just one head of state. You know that each state may have certain particular problems, they may have certain common problems, but if you're going to give, you know, particular attention to these particular states, you see maybe the environment would be a lot more producing if you did like normal one-on-one consultation. But just an old idea, the point he made. But here you have 54 states running to one particular head of state. Does that show a sign of desperation, weakness? Well, what does that show from your perspective, caller 6029?
Well, I think, you know, the bottom line is this. It all comes down to what we perceive as legitimacy. The problem in terms of the powerlessness that's exhibited by African leaders is clearly one of legitimacy. One of the things, when you start talking about the execution of power, one of the things you have to fundamentally understand is that everybody's capable of executing power. The question becomes, if you don't execute power, the question becomes why? Now, in the case of Africa, one of the things that we often assume that African leaders are somehow oblivious to the economic realities in terms of the oppression of the African continent. But it's very, very clear in terms of, you know, listening to the writings of African leaders. they're intimately aware in terms of issues like monetary policy, in which they don't set their own monetary policy. The value of the currency is not determined by African states. When we talk about in terms of interest rate, Africa has the highest interest rates in the world, but yet it has no control over its commodities. So when you think about it in terms of these structural issues that negatively impact Africa, the fact that African leaders are aware of these structural limitations but yet persist in endorsing these structural limitations suggests that African leaders have a very difficult time in terms of understanding the question in terms of their own agency or their own legitimacy. In that context, then we have to think about the psychological issue. And I think to the extent that the African leaders are willing to kowtow, in particular to the United States, in terms of its interests, speaks volumes in terms of the willingness of these African leaders, you know, to subjugate or to impoverish their own people to benefit Western states. That is clearly, you know, aside from being ironic, it is clearly there's something fundamentally skewed in terms of this kind of thinking. And the question in terms of mentality, we can't obfuscate that question. Often people say, well, it comes down to a question of economics or a question of class. Well, there's no question that these African leaders benefit in terms of playing ball with the West, in particular the United States. But the problem is this. To the extent that they benefit from playing ball with the West, they accumulate lots and lots of wealth. The question that ever becomes, even though you accumulate lots and lots of wealth, why are you persisting playing the game, which is known as counterproductive or devastating to the interests of not only your state, but the masses of your people in that state? And so why do you continue to persist in such? So therefore, it begins to come, again, it's a question in terms of legitimacy. And so when we talk about African states come together, for instance, and come to go to the U.S., to go to the European Union, to have discussions, or even China, for that matter, to have discussions around the plight of African states, it's ironic, because when you start to think about it, the plight of African states has to directly related to the policies of Western states, in particular the United States. And so therefore, when you go to these African leaders, the central African leaders go to these Western states to address the ills inflicted in Africa, to somehow expect Africans to respect the United States to say, okay, we acknowledge your suffering, and we're going to systematically address that, to assume that that's going to happen is crazy. And so the bottom line, I think it's going to take the awareness of the masses of people in Africa, you know, and it's happening, that the kind of consciousness that's necessary in terms of understanding your own agency or understanding your own legitimacy is growing in Africa. And as a consequence, what's happening increasingly in African among African leaders, you find more and more African leaders embracing Pan-Africanism in theory. In practical terms, not a damn one is going to do anything in terms of weakening the grasp of Africa, of Western states. So it seems to me as a starting point, one of the things you have to do, 54 states have to agree upon, they must control the value of their currency. That's indisputable. That is the first thing you have to do. There's no question about that. Secondly, you have to destroy those Western institutions and recreate institutions in the image of Africa which reflect the best in the interest of African states. And thirdly, you have to be prepared, if necessary, to defend yourself. Because the bottom line is you understand that in terms of fighting for, you know, for self-determination, you can understand that Western states who are conditioned to believe that they have a right, you know, to control your states are not going to take kindly to any attempts in terms of trying to change that paradigm. So you got to be prepared for the inevitable, which is the fight to defend the gains that you're struggling to bring into existence. So clearly, I think the question comes down to legitimacy in terms of understanding legitimacy. And if African leaders don't understand their agencies and coming upon the masses of people, not just in Africa, but African people throughout the diaspora, to put pressure, bring pressure to bear on African leaders who persist in playing this game in terms of legitimizing the West at the expense of African itself, at the expense of African economically and political interest. So clearly, brother, I think it's going to take the masses of people throughout the world to force these corrupt leaders to acknowledge, you know, that the business as usual is no longer acceptable, and the paradigm simply has to change.
You know, to my participants and listeners today, and listening to the documentary, I thought was a cute analysis where he made the comparison of the people of South Africa are what the people of Palestine are today. What do you draw from that statement, caller 7236? You talk about the relationship of what's going on with the Palestinians today, what the Africans been going through are today as well. What do you make or take from that analysis? Call 7236.
Well, the apartheid, its foundation is in the imperialist empire of the United States of America. And as we know, the apartheid in South Africa was firmly established in 1949, I believe, at the same time the Zionist colonial state was established. And the only thing is, this is the genocide and the severity of the genocide. Initially, when Winston Churchill was trying to find a Zionist state, he offered to have the South Africa be that site. But the Afrikaners and the British and settlers were against that. So, of course, they were offered Uganda. They split up Iraq and made a new country of Kuwait. And somehow Palestine had the misfortune of being selected. So I think what the parallel is the fact that they are colonial settler states and that they are based on extreme segregationist policies, except for right now, I feel that Israel, with the genocide of 15,000 plus people having been killed in a month, exceeds anything we've seen in modern society, other than the not often spoken about incidents that are occurring in Asia and the Biafran wars of the 60s in Nigeria, as well as the other events. I think the parallel was simply the timetable and the focus of divide and conquer, and the fact that the goal was to annihilate the indigenous people and deny their heritage. That was what was done in South Africa, and to even a greater extreme in Palestine.
Thank you, Carlo. Carlo, 4298. You made reference to African people as being the most hated around the world. God, the most hated around the world. Is hate too strong a word, or maybe because you say African people may be the most oppressed, or both? What's your thoughts on that characterization? Call the 4298.
Well, there's racism and all kinds of oppression of African people based upon economic exploitation. And Africa is one of the richest continents on the planet, so Africa is rich. We're not poor. Pan-Africanism or perish. And I say we need to unite, and the people united will never be defeated. It's a question of organization. The problem is organization. That's why we're poor, because of lack of organization. As my plan said, as for the economic crisis, we must never forget that it's a political economy. Real people engaging in real activities determine how goods and services are divided between them. Politics determines economics, always has and always will. Therefore, who is in control of the states makes a big difference. That's why these revolutionary coup d'etats are so important. Now they have to get organized. They have to look out for the interests of the people, and they have to recognize that, you know, there's a class struggle in their country, and they have to recognize that they have to correctly divide the word of truth to the people, and know that there is a small group of people whose interest is with the French and the colonialists and the USA, and they have to get the military out of their countries. They have to take control of their resources. That's what they're trying to do with the recent coups. I'm having blocks right now. But anyway, the Africa is rich, and it's just a matter of getting control of the resources. Thank you.
Thank you, Carla. Susan, in your opinion, feel like we heard this call before, Susan, just in your own opinion. One will argue when you look at the since Africans been here in the U.S., and you look at these so-called movements, civil rights movements, African people have always been fighting for unity, just to be one, to be independent, to be ourselves, not for integrating or incorporating with somebody else. He said that that's the same issue what they are speaking to, the issue of Africa being one and being sovereign, being, you know, being an independent entity where they control their own selves. They're not looking for to incorporate or to coalesce with someone. Is that the same cry the Africans over here been fighting for in terms of our independence and not so much for integration and that kind of mixture of relationships? What's your thoughts on that?
I think most of the Africans here, I think the fact is they don't really see us as being one, and that's all due to the education that we get here. Is due to our lack of even just talking to individuals about this particular subject. So therefore, it is a problem. And until we can learn to really just get our own here, to really see, just even like with this documentary, what Julius Malin was even talking about, if they could even just see something just to open up their mind, you know, and maybe we could do it through churches, educational institutions, and things like that. The thing of it is, we've been blocked, and we need to close that, open that block up so they can open themselves up to the fact that we are just one. We have to be one in order to make changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Brother Alex, you know, they want to make us think that Africa is a poor continent. They want to make us think Africans are poor people. But yet they come to Africa and they come back rich. And I'm saying this in relationship to a statement he made about the 100, there's at least 101 companies that we know of that own and control billions of dollars of African resources, natural resources, which their company has been listed on the stock market. Now, since we know some of the peoples and companies who control their own resources and making this money, shouldn't that give us more of a way of trying to figure out how to change the reality that at the minimum we know who some of these companies are? It's your response in knowing that reality, that they know there's over 101 companies that own large sums of African resources, exploit money from these resources, with very little going back to the people in Africa. So how should the leadership deal with that, knowing the reality? Just your response to that reality, Brother Alex.
Well, Brother Lee, again, you know, when we look at electing leaders and leaders that, you know, come into power by default, scoops, and we have to also realize that the most important thing that any leader should think about is his people. The people's resources or the wealth of the nation, what they can trade with, what they can develop, what they can invest with, infrastructure, schools, education, health care, medicine. There are so many things that a nation is comprised of, and most nations get that from trading. When companies come in, and we don't know how those 100 companies or better came in, but most likely the assumption of how they got there was only for one reason, and that was for exploitation. And the reason why they thought they could exploit is because for colonialism has lasted for many years. And again, when you can influence a few in a country to agree to a capitalist mentality of trading and having something, and these leaders follow because, you know, their laws and international laws, somehow these companies got in there and have a right to do business in these countries. So even these countries' constitutions or laws or whatever, you know, they allowed in to do something, to trade and remove minerals. But then you have a lot of rogue operations, you know, that are constantly, you know, also stealing, you know, on the backside. So we have to look at them also. And some of those companies, you know, I'm pretty sure they own the market too. So we have a huge issue there in Africa that these countries can pass laws that can kick these unrighteous companies that tax them, that cause them to have these great interest rates and different things like that, and get them out of the country. Rewrite the law so that when they come to trade and to do business in Africa, that it benefits those countries. Just doesn't benefit the billionaires and the investors who are putting money into there to suck money out of the country. So it has to be restructured, you know, at the country's, you know, level, and laws have to be changed. And these countries have to get together and find a unified plan. Every one or two, you know, plans, you know, last week we had a great show, you know, on this particular subject to a certain degree. And these countries have to come up with a plan to keep these colonialized countries' pockets stealing from their people, because that's what it is. Africa, yes, is tremendously rich and has a lot of wealth. And it has people wealth as well as mineral wealth. So, we, you know, we have to remember that too. You know, the people are valuable also. We were considered property coming after Africa, not because of the great work that we could do, but also for the mental capacity. Because, you know, you just can't put an animal out there in the field. So that animal has to know which way to go. He has to be. And so we were bought as property to do such. And with that idea still in mind, that for some reason that Africans are still inferior, I think that is how the trade difference, you know, is still there in dealing with us on a fair play and a fair game, because we're not seen as equals, you know, even in Africa. So we need to change that perspective out of Europeans, that not only that we are your equals, but we can also beat you at your own game. But we got to have the laws in these countries to go ahead and kick these people out and go back and get good laws that will protect the people, keep the money in the country as the goods and minerals are being, you know, taken out. Because once everything's gone, they're going to have nothing. So they have to protect what they have, and they have to do it now. Because the more longer to wait, sooner or later, these resources will be exhausted. And thank you, Mr. Lee.
Thank you, Alex. Call us 6029 on the issue of this whole idea of Africans being immigrants, being illegal what do you call it, immigrants being illegal. Illegal immigrants, okay? Africans being viewed as illegal immigrants as they travel to other African countries. He saw that as a problem because he raised the issue of the importance of getting rid of these artificial borders that were created by the Europeans as a prerequisite for this unity of African people. He labeled this as a very crucial, important point, and not to use that as a means to be divided between us as seeing us as different people. Due to the importance of this whole question of getting rid of these artificial borders and this infighting where we see other Africans as something different from ourselves, no matter what country you're born in. Why is that a crucial issue to have to be or must be resolved if Africa will have any kind of future? Your perspective from that position, call us 6029.
Well, if we're going to proclaim, you know, that we're one people, then certainly we have to act like we're one people. This question in terms of borders in Africa only serves tribal and or nationalist interest. And to the extent that it serves those interests, it inherently divides African people from one another. The situation in South Africa where decreasingly, there's been discussions around in terms of scapegoating, in particular, you know, African indigenous nationalities. In particular, when we talk about in terms of, the Nigerian presence in South Africa, Nigerians have been stigmatized as criminals and drug dealers. Of course, the bottom line is that there's a very simplistic perception in terms of, you know, the Nigerian existence in South Africa. But nonetheless, it underscores the kind of division that exists in African states. As opposed to creating a situation in which African people understand the contributions of African people generally in terms of the liberation of South Africa, at least some African leaders take a position that this characterization of Nigerians as some criminal or drug dealers is taking root. And so that kind of thinking simply has no place in terms of, you know, Africa as we seek to move forward in terms of the many, many problems that African people, African continent must contend with. Also, I think this kind of elimination of these borders is not only symbolic. I think, you know, practical purposes, I think that once you do that, it does sort of the perception of that, in fact, that we're one people. So if you, and not only that, it creates a situation where, in fact, you take ownership of the continent. So you don't have a particular allegiance to a particular state, but you have allegiance to the entire continent. In that regard, I think once you have that understanding or that regard for the entire continent, it makes it that much more easy in terms of moving forward collectively in terms of addressing these issues of oppression and neocolonialism that's sweeping the African continent. So I think from a strategic point of view, it's a very good thing in terms of the elimination of those borders, those arbitrary borders, and to implement policies in which Africans are treated to travel throughout the continent, because after all, it is their continent. In terms of being a means in terms of getting our people, just from a psychological perspective, to the realization, you know, that we're all one people, we're all African people. So I think he's absolutely correct that is a must in terms of our struggle in terms of self-determination, you know, on the African continent.
Okay, we'd like to welcome you back. Sorry for that technical issues. I understand there was a delay and not being able to hear me. We got that corrected. As we were saying earlier, we're discussing a documentary that can be found on YouTube, which is titled No African Will Pass Without Reacting to This. It's an interesting documentary. We actually go and check it out. There's so much that has been raised within this context. And We'd like to just raise a couple more questions for our participants and those who decided to fill in Mr. Page's history today as it relates to our theme, our guests, in our own home and community. I thought it would be interesting where you pointed out the contradictions of how Africans are being treated in their own home and when they decide to fight for their liberation, their resistance against this oppression. They become terrorists, they become the bad guy, they become the problems. How do we change that narrative, my panelists and analysts for today's program? How do we change that narrative, that propaganda that they have used where the people are oppressed become the oppressors and the oppressors become the victims? Response. How do you change our narrative where in their own home, in their own communities, they often make us become the oppressors. We become the bad guys, and the bad guys become the good guys. They become the victims. So what's on that? Call the 7236. So I've been waiting for call 7236 to respond. Let's go to call the 4298. 4298, caller. How do you fight this propaganda, this narrative? And when Africans fight for their liberation and freedom, we become the bad guys. You know, we become the terrorists. You know, it's wrong for us to loot, kill, imprison. But yet, when the real oppressors come to your home, loot, kill, imprison you, that's freedom and justice. That's fairness. How do you change the narrative, caller? 4298.
Well, first of all, the power to define is the power to rule, and we can't accept their definitions. We have to have our own internal definitions of who we are and what we're about, and not let others determine who we are and what we're about. And I like to say a nation is not a race, but a historically evolved community of people on a definite land. Family is the foundation of a nation, for it is the interrelatedness of the community in a common economic bond during the epoch of capitalism from which it arises. And therefore, the Palestinian people qualify as a nation, and this ghetto building project that Israel is perpetuating and forever in the never-ending war to annihilate the Palestinian people, you know, this is unacceptable. And Africa is being exploited by world imperialism, and we must recognize who our friends and who our enemies are and define them for ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you, caller. I've asked the same question. I can hear your thoughts. How do we change the narrative when we, the oppressed, are not viewed as the terrorists, as the ones being violent, as the ones who are not seeking justice? And those who are actually being violent, those who are actually the oppressors, they get to see themselves or see themselves as the victims, and whenever justice comes to them, you know, something was wrong in terms of inflicting that kind of injustice to them based upon their narrative. How do you overcome this narrative? Fight this propaganda wrong. The constant switching, making the bad guy looking good and making the good guy looking bad. No thoughts on that, Brother Alex?
Well, Brother Lee, to remain in the privileged position, to remain in the wealthy position, to remain on top, you have to, when people rise up against you and see that the fairness is not in the land, when there comes a time when people get tired, and they get tired of being pushed around because, you know, they can't vote, that they have nothing to stand up on to say that you're treating me wrong. But you have to convince other people, and mainly people all around the world, that the people that you are oppressing have no rights. They have no humanity. You have to push them down so that no one else cares about them. You have to call them terrorists. You have to call them beasts. You have to call them savages. You have to call them every kind of name that you can think of, even vermin. You have to make them less in the eyes of others, because the people that you are oppressing are the people that deserve the most rights. We have constantly, you know, since the beginning of time, had caste systems. We had classes, and they were the poor, the middle, and the rich or the wealthy or ruling class or whatever. So we've had classes since the beginning of time when men discovered wealth, and they would put one person under the other and call himself a king, and people wanted leaders and different things like that. So among commerce and trade and everything, and we involved into communities and states and kingdoms and everything else. So in that insight, humanity was lost, and people became condemned to live in concentration camps where we lost humanity for them, where we pushed them to the edge of existence in starving them and taking their homes. You know, as people move about even today, and as the gentleman said about this conflict in Gaza, when you ask to leave everything that you have and everything that you got because somebody is going to come in and basically carpet bomb everything, we have to realize that people are oppressed, and there are millions of people oppressed all over the world. You know, in every country, there is oppression because the poor and the homeless are not thought about. They're the last one. They're taxing in California on the homeless people now. They're taxed on the poor in different countries right now. Our humility for each other is being lost. And so we have to call these people that fight back, that want justice, that want freedom, that want liberty, that want to be able to trade, that want to be able to travel, like the gentleman was talking about in Africa. Whatever that the people at the bottom, the people that seek justice, want, it seems like the oppressors, the ones that have the money, the power, the influence, and the privilege, the ones that can help, turn a blind eye. And it's all about keeping the wealth and privilege among them. And that's where it's all about, is keeping it with them. And so the others suffer. We have to get beyond that as a people, you know, to continue to survive and thrive, you know, in this world and in life. We cannot continue on the road that we've been on. Yes, we have to organize. There have to be revolutions. There's going to have to be a lot of things to upset the status quo. And so I look at us going forward and Africa going forward, you know, and the people in Gaza and everyone that's being oppressed, you know, by someone else. You know, you're going to be, like I said, called everything because you're trying to make things right. And it deserts me to understand that the humanity of man itself, that the richest people in the world, cannot see your plight, and they make jokes about it. So, you know, we're in a bad place right now. But again, you know, we will have to let things in higher places and higher powers, and we have to get together as a nation and as a people and deal with our African brothers and make them understand that we care. You know, we can't turn a blind eye to Africa. We have to show them that we care, because their problems are our problems. We're talking about world problems, you know, today. This is just not unique to one person or one people. No, we're considered terrorists here if we stand up for our rights here in America. And we're looked upon, you know, and people do not desire giving you these liberties and freedoms that they enjoy daily. So I turn the mic back over to you.
Thank you, Alex. And we'll get the phone call the 6029. The same question. How do you fight this propaganda, this narrative, where they can take the victims and make it look like, you know, they are the aggressors, and aggressors look like the victims? They're constantly changing the narratives when it comes to Arab-Spartan liberation. I thought it'd be an interesting way to talk again about the comparison of what's going on with the Palestinians to historically, even today, in Zambia, South Africa, and throughout the continent, what's going on with the African people. But this whole question, how do we fight this propaganda law by changing this narrative? And when we fight for our liberation, we act as there's something wrong. But when they come in your own home, brutalize you, imprison you, torture you, I mean, you know, but no one called those particular acts out. Your response, Carla, how do you fight the narrative?
Well, the only way to really fight back, to fight against those narratives, is education. That's the only way you really can do it. What African leaders have to do is have to create the conditions necessary for the free flow of information to ensure that people get the information to challenge a lot of these narratives that are coming out of the West. I think when we talk about the role of propaganda, we understand propaganda is very, very effective. In fact, to the extent that you can continue to articulate a particular narrative over and over again, increases the likelihood that people are going to, in fact, embrace the narrative. And so, therefore, in that context, the only way to short-circuit that process is information. Now, the question is whether or not most African leaders are willing to ensure a free flow of information, because keep in mind, with that free flow of information comes information that maybe not necessarily flattering to people in positions of power. In that regard, there's a natural tendency in terms of clamping down on the free flow of information. But if we're going to move forward in terms of our fight with the West, in terms of this narrative, then African leaders have to embrace the reality that you may be critiqued in a manner in which you find unflattering, but nonetheless, in order to be truly free, you have to allow that free flow of information. I think that, you know, so when you talk about this question in terms of, you know, how they're able to flip the script, how they're able to make the insane sane, the sane insane, then we understand propaganda is quite effective in terms of creating it. So you have a country like the United States that fundamentally commits human rights abuses throughout the world, and yet is rarely called to task. In fact, it's rarely called to task because they control the narrative, not just in the United States, but the Western world generally, who soft-pedaled this whole notion in terms of the U.S. as an aggressor. So what we have to fundamentally do is making sure that free flow of information, you know, greatly critiquing, you know, the excesses of Western states is the only way we can come to the realization that there's something fundamentally wrong and that we have to fundamentally fight against that. But that can never occur without some free flow of information. So that is a struggle. So to the extent that we can facilitate free flow of information, we can fight these Western narratives which says that so Global South are the bad guys, the West, and particularly the United States, are the good guys. So until we fight that narrative, that narrative prevails and to our detriment. So we have to have a free flow of information, and African leaders have to be on point in terms of, pushing that point.
Thank you, Carla. And our last question for everyone, as relates to the article, No Africans Will Pass This Without Reacting to This, is this point of when you look at the historical development of the various independent movements in Africa, the late 50s and early 60s, when Africans received their political independence, quote unquote, there seems to be a transition from political independence straight directly to neocolonialism, where they create an environment where many Africans took on the role and responsibility to act on the behalf of their former colonizers. Given that reality, there was a recent case just came out, and I'm quite sure there are others, dealing with Malawi president, where there was a secret agreement signed between his government and the state the Zionist State of Israel, where he is shipping out hundreds of young people to go to Israel to work on farms, and he received $60 million. They are to work on these farms and do this kind of work at the rate of $1,000 a month, which includes their flight, their boarding, you know, their food. I mean, everything you basically would need to survive. They basically are given an allotment of $1,000. And not mistaken, I believe some of that money stays at home. Don't necessarily go to them now in Israel. But looking at that kind of relationship, how do we make these African leaders who have these kind of relationships accountable for those types of decisions and policies? I would just like to hear your thoughts on that. I'll start out with you, 6029.
Yeah, well, making them accountable, it's the bottom line is that making them accountable for those kinds of decisions calls for great enlightenment among the masses of people in that particular country. One of the things that we understand that those corrupt leaders inherently create the infrastructure to make sure, you know, that they are protected. In other words, those individuals who are strong-willed, who are willing to articulate the obvious, they are placed in check. And so therefore, as a consequence, you end up with people in positions of power who simply serve the interests of people, you know, people at the top. In that regard, they are unwilling to engage in any type of analysis in terms of, you know, policies that is fundamentally skewed or policy that's fundamentally in opposition to the interests of African people, the African citizenry. So I think, brother, in terms of creating the proper conditions to do that, I think is key. But I think that's part of a process, though. I think that's going to have to emanate from the bottom up. People have to come to the position that, listen, you know, given the reality of things, that without some political change, nothing is possible. In that regard, I think the mass of people have to understand that some sacrifices have to be made in terms of creating or innovating that kind of system, which can hold those kind of people in authority to account. That is a process, Brother Africa. I don't think there's any easy way in terms of facilitating that, other than to say that, you know, mass organization is going to be key in terms of if we're going to create a scenario in which when leaders do counterproductive stuff like that, they're held accountable. And I'll close with that.
Thank you, caller. Caller 4298, your response to that phenomenon of shipping out our youth to Israel for exchange of large sums of money to the leadership, to the president of Malawi as an example. How do we deal with those types of business transactions, one may say?
Well, we have to recognize that it's the people and the people alone who make history, and so we have to be united with the people. We have to be among the people. We can't just be talking about the people, but we got to be actually have inner relations with the people and look out for their interests. And if we're grounded with the people will also dialectically help us to know their interests and dialectically help us to pursue their interests. You know, without a vision, the people perish. And so, you know, we need people who agree on what needs to be done. The Pan-African agenda, as Julius Malema was espouting, I think, you know, we should be clear on that. We need an Africa without visas, et cetera. You know, in the U.S. of A, we need a government that provides health care and education from the cradle to the grave, you know. And we need people who believe that that's possible and that that's what we should have. And once people know that that's what we should have and it's possible, then, you know, it makes a difference in terms of what's going to actually happen. And so anyway, I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Let's hear what our caller 7236 has to say. Caller 7236, your thoughts?
Okay, we still have problems. I'm 236. Brother Alex, your thoughts close us out on this subject today. Brother Alex, your thoughts.
Brother Lee, you know, when I first found out about it, and I have to thank you, you know, for sending me a link. Brother Lee, you know, it hurt me. And I really have to tell you, it hurt me bad because, you know, for a leader of a country to sell out his children, you know, to another land where they even have to pay their own airfare there. They would be taken out of their wages, their room and board and all kinds of charges would be incurred, and they're only making $1,000 a month. It is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard, that a leader and that would do something like this. You know, Africa has went through some leaders that were very questionable, and Idi Amin and Charles Till and a bunch of them. So they have went through leaders that may opinions have been misguided in the helping of resources back to the country. $60 million is a lot of money. If you did not want to pay these youths, then, you know, don't charge them for the airfare and the room and board. You give them $1,000 and send them to college. Make sure that they have adequate health care. And, you know, make sure that when they get home that they do have a maybe a trust fund, you know, set up just like we have Social Security and all kinds of, you know, finance plans, you know, for later. Because, you know, we don't know how long a contract is. This was a continuing thing, you know, where they would keep coming back over and over. So depending on the circumstance, the deal should have been made much better as far as the workers were concerned. And that the gentleman himself did not receive that type of money. And even the government itself, is because it was the people doing the work, doing the labor, doing the hard part. You know, so if there was not a 50-50 share, and in this case, I feel that they provide most of the labor, it probably should have been at least a 60-40 share. But the thing was, This is not adequate. You know, this just shows you the disgrace sometimes in business that goes about in deals between countries. And we find out about this way. And we don't know how many deals like this go on every day as these kids work in these diamond mines, these kids work in gold mines, lithium mines, and their children. And they're not being paid. Their health is not being taken care of. Their education is not being thought of. But billions of dollars are leaving that country. There are many people at the top that are getting some out of it. But the workers, and I'm talking about children, they're receiving nothing but death. There's many that died. You know, what are they going to be worth if they die in Israel? How much money will their compensation, will their families receive then? Will it be a cost to ship their bodies back home? I mean, it's just ridiculous, you know, how this came about, this deal was. But again, I look at it, you know, if this was a deal that was just made between two leaders, then, hey, a lot could go wrong. But when there are more people in the room, then there's more accountability. Always less people, then there's a problem. But when there are more people in the room and there are more people listening, there are more people looking, then more fairness come about because everything is being exposed. But when things are closed, then it makes a difference. And dictators and leaders, and they do things in backdoor deals that, you know, it looks good, $60 million. You know, it's a real pain. You know, that's a good headline. But who's making something out of the deal? You know, young African males or females will be suffering in those fields. And will they have enough water? Will they have enough food? Will they have proper shelter? Will all these things be done, or will that even increase if they just wanted an extra blanket to keep warm at night? So, you know, it's just so much going on here, you know, with this. And I'm just so glad it was brought up because, like I say, we have to think about our children. We have to, and leaders of African, they have to think about their children. That is the future. And if you don't think about your future, you have none. And with that, I close.
Thank you, my brother. You are listening to Missing Pages of History, MPH Radio. We're going to take a station break, and when we come back, we're going to make a few announcements, and we're going to have a message to the community from Brother Alex. This is Radio. Welcome back to MPH Radio, December 2nd, 2023. As we speak to our theme, we are guests in our own home and community. You know, MPH Radio can be listened to every bi-weekly, every other Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, p.m. Join us. I dial in at 818-337-0016 or go to Blog Talk Radio and type in Missing Pages of History, Inc.
We'd like to thank all of our listeners and supporters for allowing us to come to your homes this evening. And we too ask you to help us spread the word, increase our listenership by sharing our program with your friends, your neighbors, your organization, your communities. We will greatly appreciate that and any contributions you'd like to make to help support the radio show. You can do that by going to Zelle Missing Pages of History 1 at yahoo.com. We would greatly appreciate it if you don't have Zelle, but would like to make your contribution to this work of MPH Radio. Please email us at mphradio@yahoo.com. We will set up another method in which how you can make your donation to this radio station. We greatly appreciate it. Like always, on the weekends, you can catch MPH TV station if you live in the area of the regions of the Richmond, Virginia area, metropolitan area, by going to Comcast on Channel 95. Go to Comcast on Channel 95 for the weekends on Fridays, Saturdays, Sundays at 1 a.m. You can view all of our past shows. So please spread the word. Again, we thank you for allowing us to come to your home this evening to help us fill in our missing pages of history. What we're going to do right now, we're going to close out this program with a message to the community from Brother Alex, and we will turn the mic over to him now. Brother Alex, what do you have for our community for this weekend? What is the message?
Well, Brother Lee, you know, we just spent a past week of feasting and enjoying ourselves and just having a great time with family. But, you know, they had to get back on the road and they had to leave us. And, you know, a few of us are making a couple calls now. You know, some of us has already forgotten those friends and families that we just shared a meal with a week ago. So we have to always go back to one of the most important things in life, and that is how we treat each other and how we see each other and the humanity of our spirit. And in that humanity of our spirit, I find strength and love and appreciation and respect and honor. And those are the blessings that I would like to give you and Susie and all the panel today, that I find strength in saying that I love you, my brothers and sisters, because we are going through something. We are going through a time like no other, but we have to stay united, we have to stay focused, and we got to keep moving on, because there are going to be a lot of voices out here that try and separate us. But the fight for our liberty, our freedom, and justice must go on. We must continue to be honorable people. So I'd like to take a moment to express how much I appreciate it, the calls and emails that I received from my reading of the Last Supper for the Native Americans. I was extended a warm reception for my research and spoken presentation of giving honor to a people that many had forgotten or had been taught an incorrect history about. I am proud of my Native American friends who are listening. I received emails that told me of the harvest festivals and the powwows that I should visit and be a part of their gatherings. I will go over the list and try to attend as many events as I can. I have found it to be a great experience and rebirth as I attended these festivals over my life. I have met many chiefs from many tribes and nations of the men of honor. Their fellowship of love and peace has inspired me since I was a child. I always wanted to be a Native warrior. I saw no fun in being the cowboy. The warrior seemed to be free, riding bareback where he pleased, living off the land and being one with nature. The warrior's life on the plains seemed so carefree and adventurous, always on the ready to protect his village, his family, his culture, and his honor. Honor, truth, and responsibility are words that are seldom spoken now, as we hear lies and misinformation every day from world leaders, presidents, governors, congresspeople, and others we once held in high esteem. Corruption, selfishness, and pure ignorance run amok in our daily lives. There seems to be no brave men with a duty to protect the elderly, the poor, handicapped, and the homeless. No brave men to stand up for the truth when lies try to suffocate the facts. No brave men to build bridges to peace when war rages all about the poor and the homeless. To find good men, you must have a good heart yourself. It is not something you are born into. Honor has to be earned. Respect has to be given to be received. Responsibility has to be a desire. Truth cannot be spoken by a liar. The spirit of man is the way of the life he leads. Good spirits and bad spirits walk among us every day. Which one will you choose to be? The natives found the runaway slaves to have a good spirit, so they helped them to survive and live in freedom among them. November was Native American Heritage Month, and I would like to give a tribute today to the history of the black Indians, who were the product of the interracial relationships and intermarriages of Native Americans and Africans. These natives fought for freedom from the coast to the last battles on the plains and beyond. There were millions of what they call mixed breeds who died on the battlefields of war and family on reservations, starving from disease and poor living conditions that they were forced into. I will attempt to tell you about these brave, honest people. The black slaves who ran off into the woods in the 1600s found Native American villages that accepted them in friendship and kinship, for their skin was different also. The Europeans had no love for either and tried to enslave them both. The Europeans told many lies to the natives and had no respect or honor as they stole their lands. The Europeans only sought to remove and replace the natives with these black people from the sea because they believed they could be broken in a strange land which they knew nothing about. The Europeans tried to kill both the natives and the runaway slaves who had formed a bond of friendship that lasts today in many tribes. The natives sought an alliance and continuation of their families as many marriages were performed to strengthen their forces. Disease was running rampant for European invaders and natives were dying by the millions in America. They combined their knowledge of medicine and fighting and were successful in many battles against the European invaders. In 1920, an estimate showed that a third of African Americans had Native American bloodline. Today, just about every African American family tree has an Indian branch. Most African Americans are proud of this family link, but did not know the history of how the native bloodlines came into their family or how it became part of their DNA. Three major races were dominant factors for hundreds of years in North America. The first was the red man, the second, the black man, and the last to arrive was the white man. They fought for hundreds of years and basically are still in conflict today. The history of the black Indians should not be forgotten as they stood and fought alongside the Native American for liberty and freedom. This truth has been hidden and lied about for hundreds of years. We as a people must not hang our heads in shame to no one. We must lift them and stand tall, swell with pride that our ancestors gave us the foundations of self-respect, integrity, character, and intelligence as a great as any other humans on this planet. Columbus stated that among the natives, he saw darker men of color, and he noted them as African in descent. In particular, King Mansa Abubakar II of Mali in West Africa sent 200 ships in 1811 with years of provisions to see what lies beyond the great oceans. Only one ship returned. So the king assembled over 1,000 ships laden with water, food, livestock, and gold, and other provisions as he made to join his men in the quest for the new land. The king nor his ships were heard from again in Africa. But there were Native American tales on both continents, along with many moss-like buildings and artifacts that have been found. African skeletons discovered in graves in the Americas show that they were from the 13th century and most likely related to King Baca's voyage over 180 years before Columbus. The Africans had successfully integrated with the Native American tribes, and they had become one people. The second president of Mexico, Vicente Guerrero, was called Mexican's greatest man of color. He was African and Native descent. He was one of the leading generals who fought against Spain for Mexican independence. He has been acclaimed to Mexico as both George Washington and Thomas Jefferson to America. He was an outstanding military leader, and he sought freedom and justice for all natives and Africans who had been in Mexico hundreds of years before the United States was formed. His courage and great character combined with his love for people made him a folk hero among his people. He called for the public schools, land title reforms, industry and trade development, fully abolishing slavery and servitude that oppressed his people from their Spanish invaders. There are so many instances where Native and Africans lived in harmony, but many tribes were threatened to own slaves or they would be abolished because the Africans sought freedom with them. In many battles, they fought together, even at Fort Negro in the Florida swamplands. The Seminoles were a proud people and thought no man should be a slave, so they fought to the death, side by side, to stop the capture and return of maroons and escaped slaves. Black Seminoles have built homes, raised livestock, raised crops, hunted and fished and traded with the red Seminole. They were brothers of the land, united, keeping their freedom. Throughout American history, the names of these men, their tribes and accomplishments, can be found in hundreds of books written of their bravery. Excuse me. We must remember these men and their deeds, as they only sought liberty, justice, and freedom from their European invaders who tried to divide and conquer them. These were great men who died for their families to survive the onslaught of the European ways, which they found corrupt and distrusting. They did not want to lose their culture and religion they believed in as they fought to the last man. Their honor and bravery cannot be denied or ignored. Their ways of dancing and joyous celebration of feast and families cannot be ignored. Though millions live on reservations today, they have not forgotten the ways of the ancestors long gone. Their pride is shown in the great powwows of today. Respect for themselves, respect for their gods, respect for their land, and respect for their culture and others is the native's way. The Black Indian accepted these traits and combined forces to be called the finest looking people to ever fight a battle by the invading European soldiers who tried to kill them. They were in the battle the skins of animals painted with colors and headdresses of feathers, and with dark skin that seemed of bronze and red hues as they protected their homelands from intrusion. Today, I thank these brave, honorable people for their contributions they made and the good spirit they left upon the land. They are my brothers. They were good men who did great things that must not be forgotten. The black Indians of the Americas. Thank you, Mr. Lee.
but you sure can't hurt. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, both for me, and I'll set you free. Rap on, brother, rap on. Well, the only person talking about love, man, brother, is the preacher. And it seems nobody's interested in learning but the teacher.
partie des dieux, bienvenue sur la terre-mer. Le nord, le sud, on brave l'est et l'ouest, on vit le rêve de
Narmère. En la tierra de nuestros abuelos.
Você sabe que as crianças são futuro, trazendo esperança para a próxima geração.
Eu dou tout pour l'Afrique de Djibouti au Sénégal. Comme bandit, tout ce que je veux, c'est soulever le Graal. L'Afrique est belle, l'Afrique est jeune, l'Afrique est forte. Enfant de la terre, mère, lève le poing et envoie lui du nord. Enfant de la terre, mère, lève le poing et envoie lui du nord.